This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Brussels says that in the following 3 days, we'll have the exit polls, right? And then it's like a preliminary result. The preliminary result can be or not contested.
And that was my colleague, Myra Fernandez, in Luanda on what's next in the Angolan election. Details coming up. Also, Ethiopian and Tigrayan rebels are accusing each other of breaking a truce. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. A new generation of Angolans, many disillusioned with their country's political system and corruption, are voting for the first time today, posing a challenge to a government party that has traditionally presented its continued dominance as a stable alternative to the country's bloody past. Voting is winding down in Angola in the country's national election. More than 26,000 polling stations were opened across the country, and voters began lining up hours before they opened. Political observers say it is a tight race between the incumbent president João Lourenço of the People's Movement for the Liberation of Angola, MPLA, and opposition candidate Adalberto Costa Jr. of the National Union for the Liberation of Angola, UNITA. There are also 220 parliament seats up for grabs. The MPLA has led the country since independence from Portugal in 1975, but some political commentators say its support has dropped over the past several years. They say the opposition UNITA has attracted many young voters as economic challenges take center stage in the country's campaign season. More than 16 million Angolans live on less than $2 a day. For the latest, I'm joined by Israel Campos, a journalist who has been reporting from Luanda all day. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Israel.
Hello, thank you for having me.
So, how are things going on in this very hectic election day in Angola?
Well, here in Luanda, where I speak from, things seem to be calm since the first hours of today, where polling stations started and to receive voters at 7 a.m. local time. So from the polling stations I've been going to and speaking to people, it seems like a very normal, quiet day here in Luanda, where people go to vote and just get on with their lives. So there haven't been many alarms or irregularities reported from here in Luanda. So everything seems to be going all right.
So have the major candidates earlier today, I mean, have they gone and voted? Have you witnessed that?
Yes, they have. Yes, I have. I have. I was at the polling station where MPLA's candidate, João Lourenço, voted this morning here in the city center of Luanda at the university. He voted with his wife, Ana Dias Lourenço. And then when he was leaving the polling station, he spoke to the press for a few minutes, saying that he called on everyone in Angola to come and vote because this is an important moment for our country. So he encouraged young people, encouraged the Angolan population to go out and vote. On the other side of the town was UNITA's president, Adalberto da Costa Jr., who also encouraged Angolans to go and vote on a historic moment, as he said earlier today. The other six candidates also went and voted already in the morning, and have also been appealing for everyone to go and vote. So at the moment, it's almost time for the polling stations to start and close, as it's been reported they would close at 5 p.m. local time. However, some polling stations that I went to told me that they would still be open until the last person could cast a ballot. So it's still something to go and watch.
So half the voters in the country are under 35 and most are unemployed. Did you have a chance to go into these voting stations and observe the voters?
Yes, I have. I have indeed. And I spoke to many of them. I spoke to a lot of people, especially young people, who told me that they have hope and a lot of optimism in this election. So they hope this election will actually help them change this country's history course, because they say that this is an opportunity for them to make the right decision so that the next 5 years can be better for them. Because the main issues around this election for the youth especially have to do with the lack of jobs, so the very high rate of youth unemployment, and then other issues such as access to schools, access to education overall, access to a good healthcare system, and other topics. So they told me that they have hope, and there is still this debate on whether there is trust or not in the public institutions. Many of them have actually told me that they don't trust the institutions, so they say they'll be very alert and observant on how things are going, just because they want to make sure the votes count.
Israel Campos, thank you for actually briefing us and updating us on the latest from Angola. You are in Luanda. Thank you for your input.
Yes. Thank you for having me.
Earlier today, I also spoke with my colleague, VOA's Mayra Fernandez from the VOA Portuguese service. She is in Luanda and gives us a quick rundown on what happens next in the election process.
The electoral law in Angola says that the National Commission has to deliver the final results until 15 days, up to 15 days after the election. That doesn't mean that in a week or in 4 days or in 3 days, we won't have the results. But the process is that in the following 3 days, we'll have the exit polls, right? And then it's like a preliminary result. The preliminary result can be or not contested by any party involved in the process or members of the civil society that might denounce any irregularity, allegations of fraud. So then the court can decide if that's fair or not. After those 3 days, the National Commission, Electoral Commission, has to start working on delivering the final results.
The election is being watched by international observers. Who are they?
We have European Union, we have CPLP, that stands for Community of Countries That Speak Portuguese. We have African Union, we have SADC.
There's the South African Development Community?
Exactly.
Okay.
Because they are working on the polls, they are not answering any questions, but we are hoping to have their representatives to talk to us, to tell us how are they observing this election day.
That was Mayra Fernandez with the VOA Portuguese service. She spoke with me by phone from Luanda. As we just heard, voters are at the polls today to decide who will lead the country, the party that has been in power for nearly 5 decades or an opposition challenger. For the first time, Angolans in the diaspora, especially Europe, voted. VOA's Douglas Mpuga reached one such voter, Edmilson Angelo, who voted in London.
Right. Feels good, obviously, to be part of the process of election. Obviously, this is the first time that this is happening. And it indeed something that is remarkable, even though this is only going to be happening in 12 countries. But for us, as people in the diaspora, being able to participate directly in the process of election of our representatives, it is indeed a very good milestone for our process of democracy. And the whole process was smoothly. And it feels really good to be part of the whole process from afar.
How was the process itself? How was it well organized? Were you many people voting today where you were?
Yes, so basically the process was very, very, very organized. It took me about, 5 to 10 minutes. So it wasn't really a big line. I guess by the time I went, obviously many people perhaps went a little bit earlier. But overall, there was a lot of people, young people broadcasting live, trying to pass, the whole experience of how things happened here in the UK to people back home. So this is, again, something that touches on the impact of the social, the digital space within Angolan politics from now on. But it was very, very smooth. It was about 5 to 10 minutes. The police, ambulance, so very well organized indeed, I must say, and it's something that is running very smoothly. So no issues at all from my experience.
In some other countries, maybe Angolans didn't have that chance, like in the United States, because they didn't register. Do you think the government in the future should encourage registration in other parts of the world where there are Angolans?
Right, 100%. I feel like, many people are actually, that are voting in the diaspora, because the votes are going to have to be sent back home to be counted. People, are questioning the transparency of the whole process. But the reality of the matter is that just us being part of this whole, process of election, we are also maximizing the voices back home, and we're also putting, shedding light into the whole process of democracy of our country. And obviously, as you mentioned, there's only 12 countries that were part of the whole process of voting in the diaspora, and obviously those are the countries where we have a big representation of Angola diaspora abroad. But the reality of the matter is that now that this door has been opened, we're definitely going to see more encouragement for the government or from the government to reach more countries where there's Angolans, because I feel like there's many countries who are watching from afar and they would also want to participate. So there has to be a huge encouragement from the government, whether it's going to be a new government, whether it's going to be a continuation of the current government. There has to be this emphasis on the inclusion of the diaspora, not just in terms of voting, but also in terms of representation within the parliament.
The government of Ethiopia and the Tigray People's Liberation Front are accusing each other of breaking a truce and resuming fighting in southern Tigray. The TPLF, which controls the region, says the government violated the ceasefire with an attack on the south. According to Reuters, a spokesman for Tigray's military command says group expects a government attack from the west. The group says that a large attack began around 5 a.m. near Alamata in southern Tigray. Ethiopia's army has rejected allegations of a military attack or build-up. The country's ambassador to the United Arab Emirates says it was the Tigrayan forces that launched an offensive. The government has said it's open to peace talks to end the nearly three-year-old conflict and would support mediation by the African Union. The Tigray forces insist first on the resumption of banking, communications, and other basic services to civilians. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. Please note, we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There, you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. Somalia's president Hassan Sheikh Mohamud has declared a total war against Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab after it attacked a hotel in the capital Friday, killing at least 21 people and wounding more than 100. Mohamed Daisen reports for Mogadishu, Somalia.
In a televised speech Tuesday night, Somali President Hassan Sheikh Mohamud announced that his government will launch a total war against Al-Qaeda-affiliated Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab, days after the group staged a deadly hotel siege in the capital Mogadishu. Mohamud said that it is time to come together to defeat the enemy, and said the military's recent operations in parts of the country gained significant ground, including in central Galmudug state and southwest state. His remarks were made after he met with the country's Security Council to discuss the latest attack on Hayat Hotel in the capital. He says he knows that the Somali people are tired of endless mourning. He said he knows that people lose their loved ones in every attack carried out by the terrorists. He urged people to be prepared for an all-out war against the ruthless terrorists who are hostile to the country's peace. He added that Al-Shabaab's only principle is killing, intimidation, humiliation, and carrying out atrocities against the civilians. He says When he assumed the office of the presidency, he promised that he will launch a fight against Al-Shabaab to end the scourge of terrorism. There has been tangible victories, especially in Galmudug, Southwest, and Hirshabelle, he said. This is Mahmoud's second term as Somalia's president. He also held the office from 2012 to 2017. When he took office in June, Al-Shabaab's leader Abu Ubaida released an audio message calling the president the worst of Somalia's politicians and said Al-Shabaab would fight the new government. The group frequently targets hotels and restaurants in Mogadishu, where the Somali officials and security officers are now together. It attacked the Hayat Hotel with suicide bombers and several gunmen. Security forces cleared the hotel after an operation that took 30 hours. Mohamed Laisane for VOA News, Mogadishu, Somalia.
Four Catholic nuns who were kidnapped on Saturday in Nigeria have been freed. The nuns were taken in southeastern Imo State. The French news agency AFP says the four were unhurt, but did not specify if a ransom was paid for their release. Violence in the area is often blamed on the banned separatist group, the Indigenous People of Biafra, or IPOB, and its armed wing. The group, which wants an independent state for the Igbo people, denies its involvement in any violence. Since the beginning of last year, targeted attacks have killed more than 100 security personnel. Kidnappings and attacks on churches are growing across Nigeria. Wednesday marks 6 months since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. It is also the anniversary of Ukraine's independence from Russia. Ruben Chama asked the UN Refugee Agency spokesperson for East, Horn of Africa and Great Lakes, Faith Kasina, how the war in Ukraine has affected African nations and refugees in the region.
The impact of the war on Ukraine is certainly having repercussions beyond Europe. Funding for forcibly displaced populations in Africa is decreasing, but at the same time, costs related to delivering assistance to these refugees are also increasing. We have also seen severe shortfalls and significant cuts in food assistance for refugees in countries like Ethiopia and Uganda, and this is only expected to get worse.
What are the new challenges that the UN Refugee Agency is facing as a result of the war in Ukraine?
The main reason why these cuts in food assistance for refugees are being experienced is essentially because of global funding challenges exacerbated by the crisis in Ukraine. In addition, and due to the increasing socioeconomic and political pressures in hosting countries, including in this region, forcibly displaced populations, and particularly refugees, may experience heightened protection risks, such as discrimination and even forced returns. Therefore, this is also a new challenge that UNHCR is facing, because on top of the day-to-day daily assistance that we are providing to refugees, we also have to put, or rather double down on the efforts to ensure that, you know, vulnerable people are protected from these very dangerous protection risks that they face.
What is your appeal to the international donor community?
Our appeal to the international community, the private sector as well, and other partners, is that this is not the time that we should all come together and provide the much-needed resources so that refugees and the communities that host them, even in this region, can come together to learn, to work, and to thrive. And this collective investment can help asylum countries in the region and beyond provide a safe haven until the restoration of peace in the countries of origin of these refugees will allow them to go back home. Ultimately, for the Ukraine situation, is obviously for the international community to come together and ensure that the conflict, you know, stops and people are able to go back to their homes and rebuild their lives.
Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi hosted the leader of Iraq, Jordan, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain for a regional summit on Tuesday. The five-party talks focused on consolidating ties and cooperation among their countries, regional security, along with investment and climate change. Saeed Sadiq, professor of political sociology at the American University in Cairo, discussed the objectives of the summit with VOA senior analyst Mohammed el-Shenawi.
As you know, this summit was sudden. It was at the request of President Sisi, and it was not clear who would be the members of this summit, but we began to see that it will include first the Emirati President, Sheikh Zayed, and then later the Jordanian King, and then we began to see also the Bahraini King is coming, and then also the Prime Minister of Iraq. So from the beginning, we began to see that members of the so-called the New Levant, which is a mini EU project that would include Egypt, Jordan, and Iraq for economic cooperation and creating infrastructure and joint roads. This is at least what is being declared in public, but it also has an aim of boosting Iraqi independence vis-a-vis Iran. There was this feeling that the Iranian nuclear deal is coming soon, and so there was a need that this alliance needs to balance, especially for the Emirates and Bahrain, who are very close to Iran, and they feel that if this agreement is signed after the American congressional elections in November, things will be very difficult and it can cause trouble. For Egypt, why Sisi made this call? First of all, Egypt is obliged to pay back $30 billion before the end of this year, which is very difficult, and they need a lot of financial assistance. They also have problems honoring some investment by the Emirates in Egypt, and so there was this important bilateral meeting to solve this issue, including El Warraq Island, which is a big project. It's a big island, and the Emiratis are planning huge touristic project, but the locals in the area are rebelling and making a lot of resistance to this project. And the Emirates were all the time putting pressure on Egypt to deliver on this important project. And so this was very important that they would come and discuss this issue.
Citing a diplomatic source, the official newspaper Al-Ahram said, a dispute pitting Egypt and Sudan against Ethiopia over its mega dam on the Blue Nile was also up for discussion. What can Arab leaders in this summit contribute to a solution after 10 years of failed negotiations with Ethiopia?
As you know, the only influential country in this issue, in addition, of course, to Egypt, is the Emirates, because Emirates has huge investment in Ethiopia, and it saved the regime during the recent civil war against the Tigray. But I don't see that Emirates is going to be responsive very much on this issue in the context of existing bilateral trade problems with Egypt. And so this may not happen now. The others may just give a rhetorical statement. We support Egypt. We do a lot of stuff with Egypt. But that's it. Nothing more than that. Otherwise, I don't see any possibility of anything happening regarding Jerd in this summit.
So what do you make of inviting these particular Arab leaders at a time Egypt is in a serious financial crisis?
First of all, Egypt wants us, you know, to emphasize that we are an important strategic player in the region, and you cannot ignore us. And because of our strategic importance, you have to also help us in the current financial problem. This is the main message that we are sending, especially that Egypt has a Suez Canal where 14% of the world trade passes through. It controls the Red Sea, the Eastern Mediterranean gas, which is very essential for the EU. And so this is an important message that we are also capable of getting important regional players to come to Egypt and have a summit.
That was Professor Saeed Sadiq at the American University in Cairo. He's speaking to VOA's Mohammed el-Shenawi. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, and our engineer, Vasco Volarech, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.